Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the March 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With me this month are Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Eleanor Richards, and they're here to discuss current-carrying wires that are made from DNA, how pig bones can be used to make better batteries, and airborne BSE. There's evidence that the prion protein that causes diseases like CJD can spread through the air. I'll also be talking to this person, who reanimates fossil proteins from the evolutionary past with sometimes surprising results.
So it indicates that there's a real contingency to the process of evolution, that the major changes that took place depended on relatively low probability events that could have happened, or if history were to take place again, it might have happened completely differently.
Joe Thornton is at the University of Oregon. He'll be explaining how he unpicks the past later in the programme. I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off this month, how do you catalyse toxic reactions safely inside cells? Phil.
OK, Chris, well, what Mark Bradley and his team have been doing is putting palladium, a metal that's normally toxic, inside of cells so that you can do chemistry inside the cells, which the cells wouldn't normally do themselves. The idea at the end of this thing is to be able to do reactions inside cells, maybe kind of build components of drugs together. So if you had two halves of a drug which were very soluble and available in the body, but the combined halves wouldn't be, then you could give somebody the two halves of the drug and the catalyst, and it would make itself inside the body.
So you're endowing cells with a synthetic ability they wouldn't necessarily normally have, and you can use other benefits of the fact that it's a cellular environment to make stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I mean, a cell as it stands is a massive chemistry factory. There's chemistry going on all the time inside it, but there are certain things that it can't do. And one of those things is things like the palladium-catalyzed coupling reactions, like the ones that won the Nobel Prize last year, the Chemistry Nobel Prize. So what these guys have done is take polystyrene spheres with a little bit of palladium inside them, and the polystyrene has the effect of cancelling out the toxicity of the palladium. It keeps it held in together and stops it poisoning the cells, but still allows it to do the catalysis.
Does this mean you have to manually inject these little spheres into every cell you want to do this to? Because that sounds quite painstaking and quite tricky work.
I think at this stage, we're just talking about cells in a kind of laboratory assay kind of state. We're not talking about in living organisms at the moment. But the key thing is that the cells survive with the palladium inside, and the chemistry does actually happen, which has never been done before.
Because normally that palladium would just kill the cell off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what reaction were they doing?
The reaction that they're doing is called a Suzuki-Miura coupling, and it's a way of forming a carbon-carbon bond between two molecules. It's a very powerful reaction that's used a lot in medicinal chemistry and drug development and drug manufacture. But the problem is nobody's ever been able to do that kind of thing inside a cell before.
We're certainly one to watch. Thank you, Phil. Now, Mike, talking about inside living cells, DNA as a molecular wire. Tell us more.
Yes, Chris. So we're talking about DNA that conducts electricity and using it as a molecular wire, as you would in electronics. So Jackie Barton and her team at California Institute of Technology in Pasadena in the US have taken a 34 nanometer strand of DNA, which is 100 base pairs, and they've passed a low current of electricity through it and found that the current goes down the DNA rather than around the DNA.
Well, that was going to be my next point. How do they know that with something at that sort of scale, that the electricity they're inputting is actually going down the DNA and not just leaking around the outside?
The experiment they've done is they made a monolayer film of their DNA strands all standing up so that they couldn't move, and they anchored it to a gold electrode. And then at the end of each strand, they put a redox probe, which is a molecule that gives a signal if a current is flowing. And then they applied the current, and the redox probe then gave the signal to say that it was actually flowing through the DNA rather than the buffer solution around it.
I suppose this is neat because it shows you can actually input current into DNA, because for a long while people have known that DNA repair enzymes check the integrity of DNA messages by sending electrical signals between the two, and if the DNA sequence is wrong or corrupted by mutation, then the electrical signal does not make it from one enzyme to the other, so they keep working towards each other doing the repairs. Where do they say this is going, though? What's the application of what they've done?
You've stolen my thunder, Chris, really, because the whole point of this research that Jackie Barton's doing is basically in DNA sensor applications. So they wanted to check that their DNA wasn't mismatched or there weren't breakages in the DNA. And one way to do that is what you said. They send a current down it, and if the current doesn't get all the way to the end, then they know there's a mismatch in the middle, so they can use it for sensor applications. Another application that could potentially be used with this is in electronics and on-chip design, because 34 nanometers is getting to the same kind of length as you would use on chips. And as you can conduct electricity with this DNA, you could potentially use it in biochips and things like that.
Thank you, Mike. And on the subject of the science of the very small, how is nanotechnology actually impacting on our lives? Kenneth Dawson is the director of the Centre for Bio-Nano Interactions at University College Dublin.
Of course, the most well-known application, I think, already is in the making of computers. For many years, companies have been working to make smaller and smaller features, smaller and smaller wires, perhaps put very simply, and other devices in computer chips. Now, the advantage of making these things smaller and smaller is that the signals, that is the electrons in these circuits, have to travel shorter distances. But the other major advantage of making things smaller in terms of computer chips is that no material is perfect, and there are often sort of impurities that bump the electrons as they pass through. So if we can make the distance travel shorter, we bump into fewer things, we lose less energy, and the computers don't waste as much energy.
Is there any evidence of this actually being manifest? It's in use and in action like this at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every few years, there's a new fabrication process started somewhere called a fab. That industry was well into the nanometer scale some years ago, and they're accelerating fast. There are many other applications which are only now beginning to become viable. I mean, let me take another one that's widely seen as important, harvesting of energy from the sun, for example. If you take a lump of something, let's just take butter for the sake of argument, and it has a fixed mass, and you start cutting it into smaller and smaller pieces, although the mass remains the same, the surface area goes up and up and up. In fact, eventually, when you go down to nanometer scale, it's not unusual to have an amount of surface area like a football pitch from an amount of material that's a bit closer to my thumbnail. So there you're creating huge amounts of surface area, and therefore anything that you want to get in from outside is more easily done.
When you first said energy and collection, I thought what you were going to say was batteries, because that's, of course, one area which is also very promising and one area we're really, really behind, really, aren't we? Because we want electric cars, we want to stop putting these horrible contaminating pollutants into the sky in the form of CO2 from very inefficient combustion engines. The thing that's holding us back are the batteries.
Absolutely. So there's, I was just about to come to that. So not only are we able to harvest energy better, but recent advances in batteries have been nanotechnology enabled. And again, for reasons not dissimilar to the ones I just spoke about. So in terms of energy storage, as well as energy harvesting, nanotechnology seems to be the primary route through.
What do you think is holding things up, or is nothing holding things up, and it's literally as fast as we can make the discoveries, they are coming through?
Things that could hold us up. One certainly would be a little bit of caution. We're seeing a bit of caution in terms of investment, because people are not fully comfortable yet about the whole safety issue and how to go forward. I think that's improving. I think we're getting there. And I think probably being realistic, you see, there might have been an error of judgment made in the early days. Nanotechnology was promoted, perhaps overpromised too quickly.
Is there any evidence that has surfaced so far for nanoparticles doing bad things? Or have people only been able to show this under artificial circumstances, that under very exceptional conditions, you can make them do nasty things?
There are several examples of explicit materials where the concerns seem a little bit more highlighted and genuine, and they should be investigated. But in a sense, that's no different from chemicals, where many chemicals are safe, some are not. There are some particles with specific surfaces, attachments, that seem to have toxic effects. And there are actually some people, actually, such as ourselves, actually make them to try to understand what those effects are, so that we can be sure that they don't happen accidentally in other systems. That would be, for example, trying to create a lot of positive charge on the surface of a nanoparticle. It's been shown to certainly have negative impacts on cells. I think the one that is probably seen most media attention is connected to carbon nanotubes. The sort of long stick-like quality has sort of drawn analogies to things like asbestos. And again, there, I think that certainly is receiving intense scrutiny, and it deserves to be shown intense scrutiny. But again, the broad understanding currently is that it's only some examples under some conditions. We're going through the examples of nanoparticles as much as possible in this community and seeing, checking the before they reach widespread use. That does seem to be possible that nanotechnology will be the first truly scrutinized technology to be introduced into society. And rather than simply see this as an exceptional negative, what we might be watching is history being made in a very positive way. I mean, one of the questions for us as a society is, do we reject things that are new, or do we reach the point at which as a society we're able to face them honestly and resolve them? And if we learn how to do that, I think as a society in Europe, we'll be able to benefit from technology, but we'll be able to benefit safely.
Which is reassuring to hear. Kenneth Dawson from University College Dublin. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, how scientists are making coloured silks by altering what the silkworms actually eat. But before that, a different beast entirely. And in fact, Eleanor, a new way to give batteries much more grunt.
Well, there's a scientist called Huang from Beijing University of Chemical Technology in China and his team. They've used pig bones as a cheap and renewable carbon source as an electrode for lithium-sulfur batteries.
First of all, explain, why do we need new electrodes for these batteries? Because I thought lithium cells were quite good.
Well, actually, lithium-sulfur batteries are better than lithium-ion batteries because they've got higher energy density and the sulfur's cheap.
But what's the problem with them in terms of the current generation of electrodes they're using in the battery?
Within the battery, the sulfur forms polydisulfides during discharge, and these react with the lithium anode so that the lithium gets incorporated in the polydisulfide chains.
Oh, and gets locked away, so then it can't take part in any further reactions, and that reduces the energy density of the battery.
Well, yes, the problem is that a lot of the chains dissolve in the electrolyte solution in the battery, so the sulfur's lost. So, see, they can't take part in any more reactions.
I see. So why are the pig bones better?
Usually porous carbon is used to absorb the sulfur, but this is really expensive to make and the process is quite long, several steps to make the porous carbon. So the pig bones are a cheap source. They were obtained from a food market in Beijing, so it's...
Presumably that's not critical to the... just a reasonable local source.
Yes. They crush the bones to a powder and then they heat them to 450 degrees Celsius to reduce them to carbon. And then they activate the carbon with potassium hydroxide, and this gives them a high surface area, so it makes them more porous, so that the sulfur can adsorb into them.
You presumably grind the bones up before turning them
yes.
into a battery. You don't sort of have a bone in the middle of a battery. You make the carbon into a powder.
Yes, they get ground up first.
Have they got any actual numbers to prove that this is better?
Well, they have said that the cycling performance is higher than normal cathodes with compact structures.
Sounds encouraging. Thank you very much, Eleanor. Now, Phil, rather worried about this one. BSE, or at least the pathogen responsible, the prion protein, doesn't just go in bits of brain being moved from one animal to another or in dodgy hamburgers. You can also pass it on in air.
Well, yes, Chris, you can, but it's unlikely to actually be a problem in terms of an everyday person catching one of these diseases. What Adriano Aguzzi at the University Hospital in Zurich and Lothar Stitz at the Federal Research Institute for Animal Health in Tübingen in Germany have done is show that, yes, it is physically possible to transfer these prion infectious agents in aerosol droplets.
I've been to a lecture by Adriano Aguzzi. He's an absolutely brilliant speaker. So what did he actually do, though?
What they did was put a load of mice in a little inhalation chamber and sprayed them with an aerosol of essentially homogenised mouse brain, or so brains of mice that were infected with the prion disease, and they found that all of the mice in the chamber went on to develop the disease.
Did they give any indication when they wrote about this about how many infectious doses that the mice were being exposed to? Because that's a pretty unusual scenario, isn't it? I mean, that must be fairly mega exposure these animals are getting.
The thing that the team stresses is very much that this is not a very realistic, real-life scenario, and it's not going to be of any concern to general people. The only thing that they think say might need to take a certain amount of heed of it is in labs where you're doing a lot of work with brains, or in slaughterhouses where you've got potential contact with this kind of aerosol and it can build up to a very high concentration. It's certainly not going to be at any kind of concentration that an infected animal or person's going to be breathing out.
And the route of infection, do they think it goes in via the nose and through the nerves in the nasal linings or lungs? What's the route in?
What they've said is that the prions come into contact with nerves in the nose and are then propagated directly to the brain.
Thanks, Phil. And now to the question of where we all came from and why we work the way we do.
My name is Joe Thornton. I'm on the faculty of the biology department at the University of Oregon. I am a molecular evolutionary biologist. I'm interested in the mechanisms by which proteins have evolved new functions over long periods of evolutionary time. So if you look inside our bodies, or you look more closely inside our cells, there are thousands and thousands of proteins, each with exquisitely well-optimized and slightly different functions. So we're interested in where that diversity came from. So what we do is we actually resurrect ancient proteins as they existed hundreds of millions of years ago using a combination of computational methods and synthetic biochemistry. And then we can do experiments on these resurrected genes and proteins using molecular biological techniques in order to understand what their job used to be and how they did their job.
So where do you get these ancestral proteins from, these fossil proteins, if you will, in the first place?
We start with a very large database of the protein sequences of present-day proteins in species that exist today, so the many descendants of the ancient proteins that we're interested in. And from that database, we can infer the phylogenetic tree, the tree of relationships among those proteins, the same way that one can use a sequence of proteins or genes to infer the relationship among species, the tree of life. So this is now the tree of proteins. And once we have the tree of proteins, we can trace back from the tips, the present-day proteins, to any ancestor on the tree and determine the most likely sequence at those ancestral nodes, the ones that have the highest probability of giving rise to all of the sequences that we see in our present-day world today. So once we know the likely sequence of the ancestral protein, we use biochemical methods to synthesize a piece of DNA that codes for it, and then take that piece of DNA, put it into cultured cells, and express it, and then do experiments on them to figure out what their ancestral function was. And then the most exciting part of this technique is it provides a platform for studying the evolutionary process and determine the effect of each historical mutation on the function of the protein.
If you've got one biological process that hijacks another because a certain mutation changes a protein in a certain way and enables it to take on a whole new function, a gain of function, if you will, and that means that it can then start doing other things that confer some kind of advantage when deployed in a certain way, you can begin to understand, I suppose, how those new things arose.
That's exactly right. So we study hormone receptors, and we found using resurrected ancestral proteins, that it often only takes one or two of the historical mutations that happened long, long ago. It only takes one or two to radically shift the specificity of the protein from one hormone to another hormone. Big leaps in function could have happened through small changes in DNA sequence and protein sequence.
Does it also inform looking in the other direction? Because you're looking backwards and then asking, how do we arrive at where we are today? Can we also take the same sorts of jumps and look in the forward direction, saying, well, where do the collections of proteins we have today, where could they take us next?
Yes. So a very interesting finding that we've had is that even though it often only took a couple of major changes to shift the function of the protein, there are often other historical mutations that occurred prior to those function-switching mutations that had to be in place for the function-switching mutations to be tolerated. So, for instance, if we take the function-switching mutations and we introduce them into an even deeper ancestor, they may actually break the protein irreparably so that it doesn't function at all. Only in the actual historical background in which they occurred can those function switching mutations be tolerated, and then that's sort of locked into the architecture of the protein from then on. Interestingly, these, we call them permissive mutations, these mutations that set the stage for big shifts in function, they usually have no effect on the function in themselves. When they're introduced, they don't change the function in any observable way. They simply set the stage for tolerating the big changes that will come later. So it indicates that there's a real contingency to the process of evolution, that the major changes that took place depended on relatively low probability events that could have happened, or if history were to take place again, it might have happened completely differently. That whole idea that our biology is just one of many possible roles of the evolutionary dice, that was really a big surprise, because most biologists look at a biological system and often think, oh, it's so well wrought, it's so complex, and all the parts do their job so perfectly, that it seems as if it has to be the inevitable outcome of evolution. But in fact, it's built on a series of chance events guided by natural selection to places that work exquisitely well but could have ended up very differently under different circumstances.
So what do you think that Charles Darwin himself would have made of this?
Now, that's an interesting question. So, you know, one of the biggest problems was he had no idea how genetics worked. You know, he didn't have Mendel's results. He didn't know how the offspring inherit many of the traits of the parents and the grandparents. And that was central to his theory. Even without that, however, his theory of evolution by natural selection and adaptation turns out to be remarkably accurate. So I think if he could take an introductory biology class and learn about the way genetics and molecular biology inside cells work and see the what we've discovered about the homology, the relationships between proteins in different species, he would say, aha, this is the mechanism that I was missing, and this is an incredible body of evidence supporting my theory. And he would be exactly right. I think it would blow his mind in a positive way.
Joe Thornton from the University of Oregon. More news now, and a controversy over gold. Eleanor.
Back in 2007, Avelino Corma, among others, published a paper saying that a gold complex catalyst had catalyzed a Sonnegut-Sheever coupling reaction. And it was a coupling reaction between iodobenzenes and phenylacetylenes.
So it could have been the gold, but maybe there was something else there doing the same thing or doing the business as well.
Yeah, so it could have been palladium impurities as they react in a similar way to gold throughout the catalytic mechanism. So Antonio Echvarn's team tried to establish the mechanism in 2010, but they found that the reaction to couple iodobenzenes with phenylacetylenes with a homogeneous gold complex catalyst just didn't work.
So what's that? What's a homogeneous gold complex? What did they actually do?
The gold was in a complex with cerium oxide. So it's homogeneous means it's in the same phase as the reactants. So in that reaction, the gold was unable to activate the iodobenzene. So they suggested that palladium impurities were responsible. CORMA has just published an article that says that gold alone can catalyse the reaction, but it's in nanoparticle form. And the nanoparticles arise from the decomposition of the complex catalyst. And CORMA has shown that actually the iodobenzene interacts really strongly with these nanoparticles.
So gold can do the job, but it has to be in this very specific characteristic or this very specific structure, which is the nanoparticle.
Yes.
And that actually gets produced as the reaction goes forward.
Well, that happens when the gold complex catalyst decomposes, so it forms nanoparticles.
And what, Eleanor, are the implications of this finding? How does this inform our understanding, and what are the applications or other ways in which this may be now utilised, our understanding of this?
Well, it's another step really in understanding the mechanism of the reaction. And Echevarren's work shows that there is a difference as well between the way the homogeneous and heterogeneous catalysts are working. And he agreed with CORMA's findings. So it's another way to look at the mechanism.
Well, on to something slightly softer now, Mike. You always get the best stories. I don't know how you manage it. Silk. You're a very dapper gentleman. You always wear nice, smart silk-type things. I'm sure, not sure about what goes on underneath as well, but I'm sure that's not beyond the realms of possibility. What about colouring that silk, though? What have scientists discovered now?
OK, so scientists in Singapore, Ming Yong Han's team at the Agency for Science, Technology and Research, have found a way to colour silk by feeding silkworms a dye.
Fantastic. But surely people have thought of this before. They must have tried feeding these silkworms stuff before to see if you can make the silk take on different characteristics and colours, surely.
Yeah, that's right, Chris, they have. In the past, scientists have fed silkworms dyes to see whether they'll produce coloured silk, and it has worked to a certain extent. What they've found in the past is that the outside coating of the silk, the sericin, is coloured. But when you actually take that away and get to the fibroin, which is the core part of the silk, which is actually used, you know, to produce clothing and things like that, that's actually just colourless, white still. The outside gets dyed rather than the inside, yeah, which is the bit you want.
And what's this new technique? Why has this worked where the previous attempts failed?
So what they've done is they've been looking at different organic dyes and studying these and feeding them to silkworms. And what they've found is that the more hydrophobic dyes they are, the more they stick and incorporate into the fibroin core. So depending on how hydrophobic it is, depends on how, you know, much dye you've got in the silk itself.
Is it fast? In other words, when you've done the extraction, does it actually stay in the silk, or is it possible to detach it and it all washes out?
That is what critics are worried about at the moment. There haven't been any studies in this paper about how stable the dyes are in the silk, and potentially these dyes could leach out in time. They don't know how stable it is. But, I mean, it's a step forward in the fact that, you know, in the past they couldn't actually colour the fibroin, so they have to go back and do a few more studies about the stability.
What colours can they manage?
They've made green, yellow or pink. And what they say is that applications in coloured silk is a given, but they're also talking about, you know, maybe instead of dyes, they can feed drugs potentially to silkworms. And so you could have a wound dressing that's actually impregnated with a drug that will help a wound heal.
Dyeing silk is not a problem. We can get all kinds of beautiful coloured silks now with standard techniques. So why would anyone want to do this? I mean, you could just adhere a drug molecule onto silk if you wanted to do that too. Why is this a step forward?
What these guys are really looking at is environmental implications of silk development and dyeing of silk. So at the moment, when you make silk, when you colour silk, there's a lot of water used for washing the silk. There's a lot of dye molecules used because you have to completely wash the fibroin in the dye, and you basically use saturate it to get the coloured silk. It's not very environmentally friendly. So this technique, you've got the coloured silk in the first place, so you don't actually have to waste lots of organic dyes creating the colours.
So you can look colourful and yet still be green all at the same time. And speaking of which, Phil.
Well, we're all very conscious at the moment of working towards kind of green technology and low carbon technology. But I thought it would be interesting to look at maybe how much money it would cost to develop some of those technologies to the state where they can be actually used by society.
OK, which technologies have you looked at and what is the price tag?
Well, actually, it isn't me that did the looking. I can't take credit for that. It was a report that's been done jointly by Barclays Bank and Accenture, the consultancy company. And they looked at 15 different technologies varying from electric cars to wind power and all of that kind of thing and where they're going to be by 2020. And they've put a price tag of 2.4 trillion euros on it.
On the whole lot collectively or on each individual component or each industry?
That's for the 15 that they've studied, for the total. To put that into context, that's 2% of the global gross domestic product, which is quite a lot of cash, and that's the amount of money that they would need to finance the whole kind of process, so to bring them up to a kind of market.
And to give people an idea, how much would it cost to develop a drug or to develop a new technique to do an experiment or a new piece of analytical equipment? Probably quite a lot too, though.
Yeah, I mean, the typical number that's bandied about for bringing a drug from its first discovery up to market is somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion, which is quite a lot less.
So green technology can still cost the earth. Thank you, Phil. Well, that's it for this month. Thank you to our contributors, Phil Broadwith, who you just heard, Mike Brown and Eleanor Richards, and also our guests, Kenneth Dawson and Joe Thornton. The production this month was by Miracentha Lingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. We'll be back to react to more top chemistry next time, and I hope you can join us. Until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.